Hi, you're listening to Road to GEM, a podcast by the Center for International Development at Harvard University. I am Usama Mohammed, an education policy graduate student at Harvard's Graduate School of Education, and I'm very happy to be hosting today's episode. This year, we're looking at the intersection of gender and international development. To this purpose, I'm very pleased to be speaking with Mr. Javed Ahmed Malik, who has worked deeply on this issue in the Global South. I found his nuggets of wisdom very valuable as a person positioning my own role in international development, and I'm hopeful that you'd find his words equally engaging. Mr. Malik is the country director of the Malala Fund in Pakistan, where his team is leading initiatives for STEM education for girls at scale and in areas particularly devoid of such opportunities. He has previously led one of the largest education sector reform programs by the UK government in South Asia, influencing the quality of education in Punjab for millions of children. His commitment to driving localized capacity building efforts alongside his work with donor programs well positions him as a guest on our show. Very happy to have you here, Mr. Javed.
Very warm welcome, Usama. It's lovely to be here.
So let's get right into it. There seems to be an increasing, and I might be wrong on this, so please correct me if I am. There seems to be an increasing reliance on empiricism in the broader human development work that's happening in these developing countries. We can see that with the increased number of experimental and quasi-experimental studies being conducted to sort of understand what kind of programs work and to what extent they work. But these approaches haven't been without their own criticisms. So, for example, some have argued that there's too much of a reliance on such methodologies to get answers to things that we sort of already know through things like people's experiences and traditional wisdom. Others have argued or have criticized these approaches to being too self-serving, being too focused on determining or developing academic publishing rather than for the actual good of the people that we're trying to serve here. In your experience in international development, and also in your experience as a broader development practitioner, what role do you think these approaches and these trends have in how we need to conduct our work? And what thoughts do you have on this matter?
Well, I mean, of course, I'm a big fan of data. I mean, if you don't have data, and you can't track progress in time, you won't be able to make any changes. So I think evidence and data is fundamentally important. But I am not a big fan of RCTs. I mean, just to give you background, that my initial training was as economist, and I was trained as econometricians also. I studied all of these regression and correlations and was... But I very quickly understood that most of the RCTs designs, they kind of exclude many variables which are measurable, and they don't bring that in. And at best, what it is doing is that it's only evaluating the very kind of subset of the reform, maybe some inputs efficiency, and then asking that those inputs only could be plugged in the system, and that would work. I don't think it would actually work at all. And actually, you know, there's a recent report by the bank which is about, you know, the best buys and, you know, the, so I don't really understand the language. And you know, you're pushing it, or you buy those seven things and you plug that in a system, and that would work. Actually, I mean, although it just gives you some clue of, okay, how are these things would work, but actually it's about the context, you know, most of this this kind of work. And there are two things to it. One is RCTs per se is not a problem. It's the way international donor agencies are advocating them as a panacea for reforms. That's where I have a real problem, because it's not as easy. You know, you got to have the contextual factors, you know, the politics, the capabilities, the culture, and, you know, how you will pull off the reform. And imagine that, you know, you just know that the three things, it's about even a very well-evidenced, you know, input. If you plug in a system and badly implement it, it won't work. My view is that while we're all moving towards evidence-based policymaking, and that's very welcome, actually, we should We shouldn't really push for just one bit of it. We should be actually saying that, well, these are the just inputs which actually have worked in certain context. But if you want to deploy them at a system level, systems are complex and account for these five or six things, which would allow you to then, you know, fully understand how you want to kind of, you know, within that system, you want to kind of integrate them. And that's how it would actually change. And I give you an example of this recent work which Kejriwal have done in Delhi to reform the schools, and a very fascinating report which is available on RISE program website. It's a classic example of how, for example, you know, the government, politicians, and local NGOs were able to come up with a model which was a system change model involving pedagogy, involving, for example, the reading and analytical abilities, and they were able to implement that at system level. And that kind of work and that kind of approach, which actually account for system capabilities, political ownership, scale, and a process management, very quality process management, implementation arrangements also, that who would do what and how all of this will be coordinated. So that's the full story of it. If we are only pushing for one particular or other particular method, and this context, this actually suits with a very typical neoliberal view of education, which, you know, you just, you know, buy a few things and it will just to solve your problem. In most cases, the irony is that these researchers are funded by loans, and those loans have to be repaid by developing countries' governments. So you are actually financing even for those experiments which are being done on these developing countries, and then you are after that writing a paper and asking them to implement them. And it's only then help people like you and me, who are actually, you know, benefit from publishing papers and being paid for it also at the expense of people who. So I actually see a lot of problem in approaching that. And I there are many examples I can actually quote. But on the other hand, wherever, for example, you had to make a judgment call on whether a particular sector, for example, in case of Pakistan, say, for example, low-cost private schooling, for example, whether that is working or not, whether that's delivering learning outcomes, I think that was hugely beneficial, because then it was already, it was kind of a system assessment in a way, right? The system was already in place. It wasn't just one isolated input. The measurement was about how is it working or not. When it was working, it allowed us, for example, I used actually quite liberally this Harvard's LEAP project in Punjab, Jishnu Das and Robbie's and other work. I think that was hugely beneficial for us back in 2009 and 10. And I have great respect for that. Other than that, if, for example, there are kind of very micro inputs about school councils or just, you know, school meals and others, they are all good in their own right, but they won't give you, the kind of a fuller range of interventions and approach you want to implement.
Absolutely. And that was a wonderful answer and an important call for intervention economists to approach their work with a bit more humility and sort of also look into how much the entire political economy goes into shaping education systems around the world. So just on the same vein, oftentimes we try to solve educational challenges with supply side interventions, such as the ones we're discussing right now. But even from other like non-evidence-based methods, like just building new schools or hiring more teachers. And in Pakistan and in also other parts of the world, this has resulted in great increases in enrollment. However, Pakistan and many other countries, similar ones, have a very high dropout rate. And that accounts for much of the out-of-school population that exists of children in these countries. What do you think is happening? Is it that the perceived benefit of education is less in these places? What's your opinion on this?
I think there's a great demand for education. The problem is schools are, in most cases, they're failing schools and they fail parents out. So I give you one example that we run as Malala Fund, a very high quality school in one part of the country, which is orthodox and conservative. And, you know, and there was a perception that, and it was extremely low, higher education rate. And now after once the school is successful, it's actually almost like one of the best schools in such context. And, you know, we have, traditional education, but we also have component of sports and, you know, chess and other things, which actually are, you know, makes the learning exciting. You know, now we have every year 50 seats and we have 600 applications. You know, and that I'm talking about an area where the perception was that it's actually very orthodox and communities won't send their girls to school. And we also had evidence that. The fact of the matter was that there's not enough schools, A, and if the schools are there, they're not functional. I mean, you also raised the point of whether, for example, we should be focusing on supply side and why we're focusing on supply side. My answer is that we should actually sincerely ask, have we actually fixed some supply side issues in public education in these countries? Actually, we haven't. You know, it's actually worse in Africa. It's actually quite pretty bad in even Asia and South Asia, for that matter. In Pakistan alone, for example, now in Punjab, which is one of the largest province, we have 114,000 teachers vacancies. They are still vacant. And in the last 7 years, since 2015 onward, in the last 7-8 years, there's not even a single teacher is hired in these schools. Now, the question is, I mean, the outside view would be, that, the donors and the government is always kind of focusing on supply side, you know, just why rooms and what. The answer is that, you know, the end goal should be first fix the school. Every classroom should have at least one teacher. And every school should have a head teacher, right? I mean, that's the minimum.
Yeah.
Whereas what is happening is that you have roughly, you know, 30 to 40% primary schools in most cases have multi-grade teaching. And I remember that I went to, for example, one school in Punjab, in Nankana Sahib or somewhere. And then I went to the school and there were like two teachers teaching 80 students. And there are 6 classes. And if you add, for example, the subjects, so they're teaching each class have, you know, 5 to 6 subjects. So, I mean, you also have a background in education, Osama. I mean, just tell me whether any learning is happening, can happen in such situation. No.
Absolutely not.
The fact is that actually it's a big problem also between policy and political elite and common people also. The states are not still able to treat citizens with some respect. I mean, imagine a world in which my child or, you know, minister's child, a secretary's child goes to school. You know, this in many cases, most of these schools are posh private sector schools. And even if on a single day the child is not attended by a teacher, it becomes a crisis at the dining table. But for example, you have half the country almost going to substandard schools and you're not willing to provide them even teachers or even proper rooms where they could sit and actually have education. So, I mean, this debate, which is about whether we should focus on supply side or demand side, is actually slightly premature in a way that the first question we should ask is that, you know, it's about whether you are able to kind of, you know, put in place a system where people are willing to send their children to school. Right? So that's the first thing. So I think the second thing is there's a huge demand for education. But this also, you know, citizens are rational, especially poor people. You know, they have to send their children, especially in the high schools. They have to make a choice. They, you know, they are very poor, mostly living under $1 a day. They also know that they are sending their kid to school. And whether he or she is learning there or not, because there's a 3 to 4 kilometers they have to go, they have to spend the entire day, and whether they're learning or not. And that's where the issue of relevance comes. And if, for example, we will not fix the quality issues now, I think most of the system leaders, they will be failing their own people by actually being complacent about it. And the way to resolve it is, A, you got to have a very high quality head teachers in these schools. And secondly, you empower those head teachers to kind of, you know, fix their schools by hiring quality teachers by, for example, fixing school building and stuff. Because, you know, at the moment, the way state is working with these schools is that they have these head teachers. They're not highly trained. They're not also empowered. Even for example, a window, if it has to be fixed, you have to write a letter to the, you know, provincial capital, and it fixes in like what, 3 years or something. And just to give you one example, if the states want to construct a school in Pakistan or in India, it just takes 5 to 6 years. You know, high school especially, because, you know, it takes, the first year is just about acquiring the land. The second year is about, you know, the budget allocation is less. You know, it's just 3 years to construct the school. One more year just to appoint teachers. And I think all of this is this 18th century, you know, colonial bureaucratic structure is not just capable of delivering education in 21st century. And that is why I am very focused in my research in recent times on, you know, not just kind of, you know, just academic fixing of the education. It's about raising the questions around system change and system level improvements, and looking at, for example, how you can upgrade the system from where it is. Because unless you don't bring in that kind of a thinking, you'll just be discussing the symptoms and not the chronic problems. You know. And the problem is that you've got to kind of, you know, make the institution of education at provincial, district, and local level work. And then the performance indicators around that could actually allow managers to deliver on those promises. And with oversight, they can actually fix that. It's not difficult. It's just about getting it done properly.
Wonderful, wonderful. So one thing that I've been thinking about, especially in my research here, has been about, like, why is it that low-cost private schools, despite the lesser inputs that they're putting into their education systems, are getting just about the same results or even sometimes better results than public schools across Pakistan? And this is true for India and other places as well. And one answer that comes to me, which is sort of resonating with what you were saying, it's like it's a matter of like how that governance works. And in the sense that in private schools, parents have an ability to voice their concerns. And quite often that ability comes through their purchasing power, that they can just choose to go to a different school altogether if they're not happy with the education their children are getting. And of course, there are some information asymmetries over there, but that's something that's happening in public schools. And this, of course, it has a lot to do with your work related to local governance and things like that. But we'd love to hear a bit about how you think that increased decentralization could facilitate increased parental power or governance of these school systems.
Luckily, I work actually mostly in education, but I also work in local government because I worked at community level for the first 4 or 5 years in roughly 500 villages and visited actually 10,000 families almost personally. So I have this, and I was raised in a village. We still live there. So that actually comes with me. Ended up writing a book about village transformation. So I think that comes with, I think we should be very careful that local government won't be able to solve your quality problem in schools. It would be able to solve your access problems. So it will be able to kind of, you know, provide you maybe missing facilities better, because the government will be closer to schools and they'll be able to give you rooms and water and boundary wall. So that's, and all maybe community engagement also in security and safety of you know, children going to school and coming back, and just better support system for school, right? But in terms of improving numeracy and literacy of children, local governments won't be able to kind of, you know, help much, and that should be the responsibility of teachers and head teachers, and it should be their domain, because academic, and within academics, you know, politicians or for that matter community leaders and others, they actually can even distract teachers a lot. So therefore it should be very careful, and rather than having a generalized opinion about it, and mostly in Pakistan also people just jump to conclusions, oh, just decentralize it, right? Of course, you decentralize it, but you should be very clear. There's few things will have to remain with the centralized system. The second important learning is is that, you know, this few of the systems are built after, you know, years of work, and you don't want to suddenly kind of drop them. And those are mostly, at the moment, in our context, their prevention capabilities. And I think that they cannot be decentralized, because you don't have, you only decentralize those things to local government where the capability is, wherever the services are more sophisticated than you can. So, for example, data collection system in Punjab and in Khyber Pakhtunkhwa, in Sindh province, you now have a very sophisticated data collection system from school. So, I mean, even from your app, you can check that what's the, you know, the teacher's presence rate today, what's the student's presence rate, what's the, you know, what's the status of facilities in schools, what's the, all of these variables, which actually Punjab Education Sector Reform, Sindh Education Sector Reform, they built capabilities in early 2000s and they put in place. That data is used almost every day for planning purposes at the provincial level. So that data system, which is a centralized system and also gives a slightly independent eyes and ears of the secretary and the minister to kind of keep checking the sector, should remain there as a provincial subject, because in the end you want to compare districts also and see which district is doing better and why, and you want to then push the deputy commissioner and district mayors to really, you know, work with you to do that. So therefore, I think, and the second is, of course, for example, the learning assessment or the examination system in which you need a complete learning rubric, item banks, you know, their sensitivity checks, the entire cycle of, you know, assessment. And that is, again, a provincial subject, and you can't actually do it at district level. So some other kind of financial factors also, like non-salary budgets which goes to schools, it's also because the finance is organized around provincial revenues and expenditures, you can't take it away. So I mean, some functions in overdeveloped and developed systems like our system, they will remain provincial, and it would be, it is actually very lazy thinking that to say that, oh, everything should be so I think you have to be very careful which system you're talking about, what are the capabilities already developed, keep those, but decentralize those which actually can be worked out at local level. But I think your wider point is very valid. I mean, there's a bit of elitism between provincial bureaucracy and teachers. And I mean, yeah, in my experience is that teachers are not given enough agency and enough respect in our system. And I mean, that is where we really need to work very hard to make sure that we give due importance to teachers. And I think that is where the state need to kind of recognize their voices and listen to them carefully, assuage their concerns, and also don't overburden them with rest of the non-teaching duties. I mean, I wrote in my book also that roughly 8 or 9 additional things which Pakistani teachers do. There's a wider context in which education works, and I think in that context, the politics of it, the culture of it, all of it is fundamentally important. That's how we should frame local government and placement of the various functions and how it should work together.
This sort of takes me back to my own time at a public school when it was during COVID, so we were the ones who had to sort of manage the entire vaccination process for the kids as well, and convince parents to vaccinate the kids and things like that. So absolutely, teachers are often overburdened with things that are definitely beyond their job description and act as the instrument of the state to interact with citizens for whatever purpose that may be. I also would like to hear a bit about the international development sector's experience with localization and using grassroots institutions for program delivery. What's your experience with that been like, and what do you think needs to be done more for capacity building of local agencies?
I think that, I mean, now I have much more clearer ideas about it. I now reach to a conclusion that you cannot manage development in global south from global north. And this kind of, you know, fact that most of the international development agencies raising funds in the name of, you know, these developing countries they end up having, you know, their headquarters internationally with mostly international staff who don't have enough deeper experience of Global South. Actually controlling not just the resources, but even, you know, micro decisions on how development should be practiced at the local level, right? So that's a complete disregard of the experience of, you know, the not just the local staff, but also you cannot, I mean, it's actually, to be honest, if you look at, you know, the corporate sector, you see, ironically, they're much more decentralized, you know. I mean, Pepsi Cola, Pakistan would have their sales strategy, and the country team would depend upon the Pepsi Cola district level managers, and they'd be very decentralized in choosing the kind of partners and in closing partners and trying to make sure the bottom line and the sales, you know, work. So, I mean, but in development sector, you would find, for example, you know, most of the decision making on day-to-day basis even is centralized, is being done by all great colleagues and friends, and we all work together. But I mean, it's about talking about the principle. The principle is that while sitting in Massachusetts, if you are deciding about a charity in working in Ghana, about, you know, how a certain manager should do capacity building training, you know, and whether it should be 1 day or 3 days, you already are actually already, you know, it's just killing the purpose, because it's about, I mean, the bottom lines have to, you should focus on big picture impact, on unblocking funding, on also making sure that the money which is being sent is through safer financial systems, that there are enough better anti-corruption measures, there are safeguarding, you know, safeguards there. You know, you build those systems. But within those frameworks, then you allow you know, country teams to kind of, you know, then show much more agility and pace actually to deliver the program. And I think that's happening mostly because the sector still doesn't have a delivery mindset. They still have a very thinking mindset. They like to just think through it to just each other and all the time, and takes a lot of time in rolling out ideas and delivering it. And actually, it is a big problem, and it causes most problem in humanitarian response, especially more, because that's where the time, that's very time sensitive. You know, of course, in education, we can delay some trainings from here to there and delay some funding from one quarter to another. But imagine in emergency education or in humanitarian response or, you know, food distribution, others, where there's a race against time to save people. The international aid architecture, you know, have been extremely slow, and people are just assessing still in 3 to 4 weeks. And now, new charities, I mean, some charities are bolder in it, like Islamic Relief, for example, is extremely bold and already sending, you know, response earlier on and doing assessment in the meantime. And others are trying to learn, and localization agenda is being talked about a lot. But we have to do it in a much kind of, you know, rapid pace, and try to kind of, you know, have a delivery mindset and try to see that how big picture results should be achieved. And the focus should not be on just processes. It should be about kind of, you know, the results out in the open and achieving those results. Because we have a big responsibility as an aid sector. You know, the monies are drying up, the economy, austerity measures, economies are. And we have responsibility to make sure that, you know, whatever we have, we should be able to deliver that in time, with quality and taking a longer term development in mind. And we should be rigorous about our model, keep on reflecting about it, asking tougher questions, but only around impact, and not just about, you know, just additional managerial procedures and which actually can delay implementation.
No, absolutely. International development agencies definitely need to think more on their reliance on their bureaucratic structures and be a bit more outcome oriented, like you pointed out, that the corporate sector may be able to do. So, of course, the corporate sector has a bottom line that it needs to meet, and so it will choose whatever process it can to meet that bottom line. And definitely, international development does not think that way. Mr. Javed, let's sort of switch gears a bit now. So as we have our Global Empowerment Meeting coming up at the Kennedy School in a few months, This year's theme is on international development and gender. So my question to you is that in contexts, including Pakistan and other places as well, where education systems seem to be failing most children, why do you think it's essential for there to be targeted work, especially for girls? And in what ways are their challenges a bit different?
Oh, it's foundationally important, because in this day and age, for example, if you still have large gender disparities in education, it's unacceptable. And it's unacceptable because, you know, the world have agreed long ago, actually, 1976, agreeing on economic, social, and cultural rights, that the state is should be able to kind of guarantee right to education, and you know, but the girls are there are structural constraints which actually push the girls always behind. A, you don't find many women leaders in ministries. I mean, you find, for example, very rarely an education minister or education secretary or the core leadership having women representation. So it is about representation first, you know, so that they not only they should have seat on the table, but they should have real power to change things. So I think that is where also you have less and less people. And I think that in developing countries more actually you've got. The second thing is that the girls, not just the representation, but if you look at the numbers also, and even in our own country, you see, you know, in especially at the middle and high school level, that's where Malala Fund, Malala works. It's actually astonishing that some of the numbers in Pakistan at the high school enrollment level are less, it's just close to what sub-Saharan African numbers, you know, the net enrollment rate at 9th and 10th grade, survival rates are low. And the data suggests that if you are a rural girl, you know, if you're a girl in the age bracket of 10 to 16, living in rural areas, you know, at the most probably, you'll be out of school. You know, so there are 40 districts in Pakistan where you have extremely. So I think that is fundamentally important to, you know, bring. It's not just a question of affirmative action and bringing that up. It's also about making sure that they should reclaim their agency and should be seen differently in society. The program which I am running and Malala Fund is generously supporting is to ensure that the access retention and completion at the middle and high school level, which has been actually neglected, category aid agencies have been working mostly in primary education. But that is where we want to focus on making sure that girls reach school safely. They are able to have a great learning experience and they should be able to retain themselves in school and they complete their education. And they have life chances which improved and their agency at a country level is recognized and girls should aspire themselves to be scientists and, you know, engineers and sportsperson and bureaucrats. And, you know, it's fundamentally important to give them new role models in traditional societies like Pakistan. And there are additional benefits also. You know, there are benefits of delaying marriages. Also, benefits of there's evidence that if you have educated women, you normally have the fertility rate also goes down. The economic conditions move up. A literate mother generally is able to have much better, for example, nutritional gains and academic gains of the child. All of those economic gains, but I think I approach that mostly from the human rights perspective and our ability to kind of, you know, recognize that what place they should have in society. And that's why I think it's foundationally important for us as Malala Fund that they should be having, you know, right representation also. So therefore, girls speaking to power is one part of my programming in which, for example, we gather these girls from schools and ask them to ask direct questions from ministers. And, you know, just to kind of, they should be able to, over time, through their struggle, reclaim the agency. So I think as we move forward, if you look at the, and you're right, that international development should prioritize girls and gender. Because if you look at the numbers also, they are the largest excluded group from the entire prosperity and boom and the political, you know, the entire boom which we had in the last 30, 40 years, the women especially and girls, they have been excluded from it as one of the largest, actually the largest group in terms of, access to schooling, access to economic opportunities, access to a right to control their own destiny. So I think it's rightly been prioritized at international level, at Harvard, other places. And it's very important for us to, whenever we speak about development, we kind of raise this as an issue.
Absolutely. This is something that in principle is, of course, as you pointed out, it's worth doing. But then also, there are other kinds of special payoffs that we're getting from educating girls, such as the ones you highlighted. And that's why it should be prioritized. Finally, Mr. Javed, I have a question, which is, imagine a future where gender takes center stage in international development. What does this future look like? How do initiatives operate within this structure, and who is leading?
Well, I think it's not just international development, but in general, I think if you have a more equal world with equal representation of women, it will be a much better place. I mean, you will have much more empathy dealing with even foreign policy or dealing with trade, because you will bring in human perspective, right? And also how, for example, workers are being treated. And if there are mothers, for example, do they have daycare facilities? Do they have, better conditions where they could actually raise their children, but at the same time could actually work and develop themselves? You'll have much more presence of women leaders from every background. I mean, because it's not just about being a woman. In some cases, they have to deal with additional constraints also. Imagine you're a woman, but you're also a minority from minority religion. You are for example, Muslim majority state in Pakistan. For example, if you are a Christian woman, then the odds are against you at every level, right? And imagine if you are also having some kind of disability, then you have even further limited ways of exercising your identity and ability. Or if you are having all of these three things, then you're based in the rural areas, from where it becomes doubly difficult for you to really move to the city and try to do something. So, I mean, that's why for us also, it is important when we're recruiting people just to kind of look at the journey and trying to kind of, remove ourselves from just, obvious success indicators, or somebody's from Ivy League or good internships or maybe, but then just look at other people who, from where they have started, right? Maybe they have started from a very tribal context. Maybe they were in conflict zone and survived wars and, these. And from there, they're able to reach to this place and are kind of, So therefore, we have to move beyond these kind of so-called upper class success indicators, which we have developed and sticking to them. It's about equity, looking at, and believe me, if you start accounting for those things, you will have, your workplace will be much more diverse. You will have much more sensitivity in how you design your programs. You have much better understanding of inclusion. And you will have, much better ways of working together, because it's actually accounting for all kinds of, different talents.
Thank you for sharing those thoughts with us, Mr. Javed, and for making such a strong case for why all of us should work towards further gender parity as development practitioners. And even more so, thank you so much for taking out the time to speak with us today. Your thoughts, I'm sure, were as valuable for our audience members as they were for me. And to our audience members, we really appreciate you listening in. Over the next couple of weeks, please stay tuned as we hold even more conversations with many other individuals working in international development and hear what they have to say about these topics. Thank you for tuning in, and take care.